Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
On today's episode, Sir Tony Robinson is here.
I'm going to be talking about my new book, The House of Wolf, and about how my obsession with history and archaeology has transformed my entire career.
Yes, hello, and welcome to the Time Team podcast today with Helen Geek, and with me for the whole episode, the man who has been at the heart of Time Team since the beginning, Sir Tony Robinson. And we're bringing two podcasts together today, Time Team and Cunningcast.
What a brilliant thing to have done. Why didn't we think of it before?
Absolutely. Now, Tony, it is lovely to see you. How are you? Are you very, very busy?
I'm as busy as I always am. I've just started the second book. House of Wolf is going to be a trilogy. I don't know the name of the second book yet, but I've done the first draft of the first 10 chapters. Oof. And given that I wasn't going to start till the new year, I'm, for the first time in my life with a book, I'm slightly ahead of schedule.
That's brilliant. I can't wait to know what it's going to be called and what it's going to be like. But to start at the beginning, tell us a bit more about how you originally got involved with Time Team, because it is quite an interesting story, isn't it?
Well, I was working at the theatre at Chichester, a gorgeous, gorgeous amphitheatre at Chichester. And it was at the time when they were excavating Rome and Chichester. It was the same bunch of people who had just been digging at Fishbourne on the south coast and had found that wonderful Roman villa. So they were able to use their skills in order to do something which was a bit more like the kind of test pitting that we do nowadays. And you couldn't just lift up the whole of Chichester and see what was underneath it. You had to do discrete little investigations into various parts of it and try and get a picture of what the Roman town was like. And I didn't realise what these people were. They were all very scruffy and smoked Rizzlers, and they looked rather like the people you found hanging around outside Tesco's with a dog in a tin. They all had degrees in archaeology. Many of them were masters of archaeology, the occasional prof. I found them absolutely so interesting. It's hard to describe. They just had a different attitude towards life, a different attitude towards history, which I'd always had a bit of a passion for. I got interested in them and in what they were doing. And at the end of my term in Chichester, I went back to Bristol and started doing extramural courses in archaeology at Bristol Uni, which were run by a young lecturer called Mick Aston. And he and I got very, very close, very, very friendly. By this time, I had become something of a celebrity on television, but he certainly didn't want to know that. He was contemptuous of my fame. And he took the mickey out of me all the time. I took the mickey out of him. I said how he was desperately still trying to be a hippie well into the 1980s. He was like a refugee from Woodstock. And we argued about politics all the time. We were both on the left, but he saw me as part of the opportunistic left. I saw him as part of the fantasy left. Meanwhile, while all this was going on, Tim Taylor had come up with this idea of archaeology in 3 days, which he'd pitched to Channel 4. Channel 4 called me in. Channel 4 in those early days really loved to do daft things which would get everybody talking. And their idea was, if we're going to do a series about this arcane subject called archaeology, who should we choose to front it? Why don't we get the man who is renowned for being the most stupid person on television? Which was me as Baldrick. So they pulled me in and they were gobsmacked by the fact that I knew about archaeology, albeit, you know, very much in an amateur way, but I knew how to interrogate the archaeology, which is what I think we say. And so I got very excited about it, and thus the marriage between me and Time Team was born.
So what was it about Time Team that made you want to do it, though? Because it was not the standard normal archaeology programme. It was so different, wasn't it?
There were two things, I think. One of them was purely, as it were, stylistic in my job as a television person. I had done a little bit of presenting for Comic Relief via Blackadder, because Richard Curtis, who started Comic Relief, also started Blackadder. And I'd gone out to Africa, and having been an actor constrained all my life by other people's writing, by my responsibility to the other actors and the audience, etc., etc., suddenly I found myself unconstrained making documentaries. They were my essays, as it were, albeit in collaboration with the director and producer. And so I was very excited by that, and I wanted to extend that. So whereas I think where a lot of actors, if they'd been asked to present, would have gone, oh, no, darling, I'm sorry, but I'm an actor. I didn't really feel that. I felt like it was a new, something new to do. And I also thought, as you've just said, that it was a very new and exciting way of doing it. It was much more improvised. And also, the people who were doing it, they were very political, and I don't mean that they belong to particular political parties or anything like that. What I mean is that they were virtually all community archaeologists or archaeologists committed to the community rather than academics. And they wanted to share what they knew with other people. And I had always been of that bent anyway. I'd left school at 16 with 4 O-levels. I felt very punchy about academic people. Why are you talking in that tone? Why are you calling your discipline archaeology, which is an absurdly obscure word which nobody can even spell? If that isn't an indication of how ivory-towered it is, what else could be? So, yeah, so I loved the idea of kind of ripping a discipline open. But it also coincided with my passion for history. I know archaeologists will always say archaeology isn't history, you have to keep them apart. But for me, it always was, or at least it was part of history. It offered us great markers about what was going on at particular times in history, and I really warmed to that too, and thought it had the potential to generate lots and lots of stories. And as a storyteller, that's really what I wanted to do.
Yes, and those stories tend in archaeology to be about the kind of people that don't make it into the history books, don't they? That archaeology shines a light on people who just lived normal lives, discarding things, losing things, building things, knocking things down, digging holes, making banks and ditches. They're not the kings and the queens and the generals and the captains of industry that we learn about at school in history. Given that archaeology is about the people who don't make it into the history books, were you surprised that it became so successful? Because after all, we're telling stories about people who we haven't even got the names of.
The reason that Channel 4 wanted to do it was because they had a series called Treasure Hunt with Annika Rice, which in a way had a very similar to shape to Time Team. It was about a series of clues being unveiled throughout an hour by a presenter, at the end of which the television audience gets the reward of something treasury at the end of it. So in that sense, Time Team was about finding treasure, although not in the way archaeologists think of it. It wasn't about trying to find the most valuable thing you possibly could. It was trying to get the reward of something exciting at the end of a long run. So that meant that even though it was highly unlikely that we would be able to dig up a necklace belonging to Eleanor of Aquitaine, what we could do was find the mark of ordinary people and find it in a very dramatic way. And that's what the reward would be at the end. So it didn't matter that what we were finding was the mark of ordinary people in the landscape, as long as we could construct it in such a way that in the last 5 or 10 minutes, everyone went, wow, it was worth doing, because now we've unveiled a whole story. Which I suppose is slightly manipulative, but it was as far as we got as with manipulation. It was genuinely a very real program about real experiences of us digging up things. And I think I very quickly discovered how exciting it was when you got the mark of an individual person in the landscape, when you had a sense almost of the autograph of somebody. Literally sometimes, like if you were digging up a medieval site where there was some wrecked hall or something, and you'd come across two pieces of wood, and you realise that actually originally there had been a joint. And how do we know that it was a joint? How do we know it was the right joint? Because the carpenter had done a little squiggle on both sides of the joint, so he would know not to get them muddled up with other pieces of wood that he'd cut. That was some person who had done that little squiggle. I remember vividly in Coventry, there was an old cathedral that had been smashed to bits by Henry VIII. And there was a piece of a column, but like you don't sort of start with a long stone of tube and carve all the way round it. You cut out bits and put them into the column. So what we'd got was this carved bit on the outside of the column and then flat faces which would go into it. And on one of those flat faces, in a rather similar way, the mason had done this squiggly pattern of what it was he wanted on the outside face. And I had this vision in my mind that the mason had turned to his apprentice and said, look, I'm just going down the caff for a bacon sandwich. You see what I've done here. You cut that roughly into the front face and I'll finish it off when I come back. So those kinds of things I've always found absolutely magical.
Yes, it's a kind of mixture, isn't it, of a story that it's that the story that is quite hard to tell in the past because you don't have all those details, but you dovetail it in with the story of how we're discovering this in the present, and all of a sudden it becomes completely compelling, doesn't it?
That's right. I think that sort of combination and contradiction between present and past always was really part of the magic of Time Team. People will talk about Phil an awful lot. They'll talk about Mick. In the early ones, they talk about Robin. They talk about you. They talk about Carenza. It's odd that they should talk about these people in the present and the kind of banter that we all had with each other. But it was that contradiction between we in the 21st century, having our little adventures, doing things about the medieval, the Anglo-Saxon, the Roman period, or whatever.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Now, talking about adventures in looking into the past, we definitely need to talk about your new book, The House of Wolf. Now, what inspired you to write it?
I've always been fascinated by Alfred the Great. I can remember when I was 8 or 9, seeing the Lady Bird book of King Alfred for the first time. And in it, there's that iconic picture that most people, you're nodding already. Most people
of our
generation.
Well. Yeah.
you've got the king gazing into the middle distance, haven't you? Looking very kingly. And you've got the peasant woman at the door of her hut holding a big stick, looking like she's going to whack him. And in front of the two of them, there's the smoke and the cakes on the smoke. And stupid Alfred has been so busy thinking about all his kingly things that he hasn't noticed that the cakes, which may well have been all that the peasant woman would be able to afford for the entire week, had asked him to look after. And I know now that there's always been a wrestle to understand precisely what the significance of that story is, and different historians come up with other ideas. There is this, I think it's pretty commonly thought nowadays amongst historians and those who know, that actually that story was only linked to Alfred between 50 and 100 years after he died, and that originally it was a story about someone else completely, that was just bolted on to Alfred as part of the PR of Alfred that gradually began to develop after his death. So that the enigma of that image struck me as a kid. And then when I was in my teens, I discovered that he was the only king we've got who we call the Great. Why do we call him the Great? Partly because he was never trained to be king. He was the youngest son of the House of Wolf, which is the name of my story, Æthelwulf being his father. He had other brothers and a sister, all of whom were deeply ambitious, and in my book, not really cut out to be king at all. Their father was old, despotic, with early onset dementia, but he was still able to hold on, rather like the Brian Cox character in Succession. And Alfred turned up on the scene after the other brothers had been killed by the Vikings. Initially, it seems as though he was a pretty rubbish king, but eventually, when Somerset was only about 10 square miles of bog left as Wessex, all the west of Wessex had been taken over by the Vikings, he suddenly turned everything round, became a fantastic general, defeated Guthrum, the leader of the Vikings. Wessex became all-powerful. He annexed the next kingdom, Mercia, the Midlands, and first of all, there was that vision of the Anglo-Saxons that came out of that merger. Latterly, it became known as Angleland, England. So Alfred and his son and his grandson, as it were, created England. So you've got this fantastic, enigmatic character and the creation of England. To me, that was far too seductive to leave alone.
Ah, but you do also wrap it up with a fantastically complicated political murder mystery thing that's going on in Rome, don't you? I mean, the bits that are set in Rome I found equally compelling, even though I do adore the Anglo-Saxons. So give us a quick outline of the plot, if you can. I mean, I do know it's fiendishly complicated, but roughly.
Well, can I talk about that complication first?
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly that I wanted to be complicated, or that's part of the writing. I wanted it to be a saga, like the Forsyte saga, like the Lord of the Rings, like Bleak House, I think, is the perfect example. Bleak House by Charles Dickens, which was originally serialized week by week or month by month in the magazines. So everyone was gagging to know what was going to happen to the characters. I was also very influenced by the recent wave of Netflix and HBO sagas, like Succession, like Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, I think, is the perfect example, where you've got all these different kingdoms doing different things, almost occupying different periods of fantasy history, with dragons rolled in as well. And you think, why are all these different kingdoms and stories in the same meta story? And the answer, of course, is because gradually they all merge together till by the end you get this reward of understanding what they're all doing. And that's what I wanted to do. So that, as it were, is, as a writer, structurally, what I wanted to do. As someone who was interested in history and in politics, I also wanted to demonstrate that the kind of isolated England or Britannia or Albion that we tend to see in various moments of history is actually incorrect, and that virtually all the time we have been in dialogue with Europe. For an awful lot of time, particularly after the Norman conquest, we were ruling massive chunks of France, for instance. And in Alfred's time, the relationship between Rome and Proto-England was really, really important. And my argument is that Alfred wouldn't have been able to do all the imaginative things that he did as king, like transforming the currency and the architecture and building these new towns, the burghs, and doing all this wonderful translation of ancient manuscripts that he did. He wouldn't have been able to do any of that unless he was rooted in an understanding of the kind of new thinking that was happening both in Rome and in France and Germany under the new Holy Roman Empire. Sorry, you're asking me questions which made me want to talk an awful lot, but that's what I was trying to do. That's why I was so fascinated by the Roman element, because it seemed to me so hugely important in the transformation of Wessex into the beginning of England.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely totally right. I mean, that's one of my great beliefs about the middle and later Anglo-Saxon period, that everybody, well, right up to the present day, everybody's always been trying to recreate the Roman Empire, and it started back then, even slightly before Alfred, but at that point everybody is trying to take what they can, to learn what they can from Rome. But so the episodic structure that I really like, all those little chapters, I was wondering whether you originally wrote it in those small chapters, or did you write it as one and then break it up? And how do you go about it?
No, I did write it in individual chapters. And my mind was kind of split into five all the time that I was writing. Ooh. I just always wanted to keep those balls juggling. I think if I'd written the original storylines as four or five different stories and then chopped them up and put them in, it wouldn't have been nearly so organic. And I wanted always, when I wrote the next chapter, even though it was, say, one chapter was taking place in Aix and the next chapter was taking place on Lindisfarne, I wanted the echoes between the two stories still to be there, even though at that time the stories were different. Sorry, that sort of sounds a bit pretentious. I don't know an easier way of explaining that.
No, I think that works really well, because you do realise that of course you have to know what's going on in all these different places. It felt to me to be, well, I'm really waiting for the film to come, because because it struck me that it would work really well as visually. And I love your dialogue, which, of course, having spent years for you writing television scripts and writing your own presenting stuff, I suppose you do get a very good ear for dialogue, don't you?
I think the writer I'm most influenced by, although I'm not trying to, you know, compare the meagre talents I have with his extraordinary talents, is Charles Dickens. Because, like me, he started off as an actor. And I think you can see in his writing that he is he's kind of imagining it in a very theatrical way as he writes all these characters with these slightly absurd names, the vividness of the surroundings, the page-turning plots. I always feel that he is writing as though he is standing on a proscenium arch stage, declaiming the story, while behind him are all the scenic cutouts of the bits of the story that he's telling at that moment. And I'm doing something similar, except I'm doing it in movie or television terms, but still kind of, it's as though I'm acting in my own book as I as I write it.
And do you think that your experience with Time Team has helped shape your writing and what you're interested in bringing forward and showing?
Enormously. And I'll tell you what it is, Helen, and I know you'll understand this. When people say the word archaeology who aren't archaeologists, I think immediately their minds go to Egypt,
yeah,
or Greece. Very warm climates, finding these amazing things, and then probably going home late afternoon for wine and tapas or whatever. When you and I say the word archaeology, we think of the cold.
Uh-huh.
We think about our knees going. We think about being chapped. We think about still having to go on well into the evening. And yes, going to the pub, but going to the pub really tired and actually getting pissed very quickly because we're all so tired. There's something about the tangibility of Britain that has seeped into my blood, into my mind, and into my heart over those 20 years of doing Time Team. When I write the story that I'm writing, I want to be able to feel the earth. I want to be able to smell it. I want, when the food is cooked, I want us to really get the pong of that food and the food unprepared. I'm writing a chapter at the moment in the second book about some monks who get this surprise gift of a large perch and how they have the conversation while they're gutting it, and after they're gutting it, they're rooting through it with their knives to see which bits of the offal they want to drop into the stew. It's that kind of tangibility that that I think I got out of Time Team.
Yes, because I did notice there's a lot about food in the House of Wolf, and I hadn't really linked it with the fact that there's always been quite a lot of food and drink experiments in the cameos on Time Team. But so that leads me on to, I wanted to ask you what you thought of the new online Time Team and how much you think it allows us to do things that we couldn't do before.
That's a very interesting question. I love the new Time Team format. I admit that I didn't think I would, because when I think about online, I think of something that is a bit slightly slapdash, that's put together not really as a piece of fine art, which I think that the original Time Teams really were. They were extraordinarily, professionally well-wrought storytelling. And I didn't think we would be able to do that, both within the budget we would be likely to have, and because we wouldn't want to and would be able to carry all those techie men and women with us that made Time Team. What I realised pretty quickly was that the new Time Team was a different form, just like the novel is a different form from the Grecian urn. They may write, you know, they may depict the same moment in time, but in very different ways. I came on board with Time Team. I had lots of conversations with Tim Taylor about it, and I'd remained close friends with a lot of people involved in Time Team, including yourself. I came on board when he started talking about the documentaries. The documentaries which have been the form that I've enjoyed doing the most in Time Team. But then, when we went to Sutton Hoo, I realised there was a kind of improvisational way in which the shooting was being done, which I absolutely loved doing, which I couldn't really do on Time Team. Although Time Team had been a big jump in my experience as a performer, it had always been very constrained by the director, by the fact that we've got to move on to the next trench within 3 minutes and tell that part of the story. Here, I could just bounce about like a lunatic, pulling together the story in a much more genuinely experiential way. I mean, you and I, it's been quite absurd. I can remember I said something so stupid one time that like John Cleese, the only way out was for me to fall over. Yes. And I can remember you saying, why are you asking her that question? You asked her exactly the same question 3 minutes ago. And it's fun, and it is improvised, and it's I think in a way it captures the reality of the archaeological struggle probably much better than the original Time Teams.
Yes, I definitely agree. It gives us an extraordinary freedom to do all sorts of different things. And talking of all sorts of different things, I'm wondering what you're looking forward to in the future with Time Team. But just before you answer that, I want to make sure that you're going to agree in public to come to King's Lynn Guildhall, the longest running active theatre in the country and possibly in Europe. It's been going since about 1400, and is has the boards on which Shakespeare may have performed. Now, I really want to get you as an actor into King's Lynn Guildhall, and I'm putting down my marker in public for this. But what else are you looking forward to over the next year for Time Team, do you think?
Well, let me stay with that one for the moment. I absolutely, I'm gagging to go to King's Lynn. It's just a question of when it's best to get me out there to encompass the revealing of the best bit of archaeology. But I'm standing by waiting. I can't think of another piece of archaeology that I've been so excited by, I suppose, since the discovery of the Rose Theatre.
Brilliant, because I want to get you to see not just the archaeology, but I want to see what you think of the acoustics and the whole way in which it works as a building, which of course it can't do until we can't see until quite late on in the project.
I will bring my theatre makeup with me, darling.
Brilliant, brilliant.
As far as the other ones are concerned, well, Time Team keep waving little baits in front of me, and every one of them I actually find really, really exciting. John Gator has been living up in the Scottish Isles now for a number of years, and he's got a lot of discoveries. And the Ness of Brodgar he spent an awful lot of time in, and has made a major contribution to it. And I would love to. I've been there once, but really just only to, not with Time Team. I think it was with a documentary, and it was only really just to observe it for about 6 hours. I'd really love to do a deep dive into that. There's also talk about the possibility of Viking boats as yet undiscovered lurking under the ground somewhere around there, which I love the idea of. And Sutton Hoo, of course. I don't feel our job is done at Sutton Hoo yet, and I hope Sutton Hoo and I hope the National Trust don't think so either. I've been up there recently. I've been up there with you, haven't I, on my book tour?
Yeah.
That was a sort of theatre book show which was produced by and inspired by Sutton Hoo and the people who worked there. And so my relationship with it is palpable, and I'd love to go back there.
That book evening was really great, wasn't it, in Woodbridge, in the cinema there? We had a full house and a really good chat and some great questions.
It was wonderful. And you know what the highlight was for me? And I was really quite moved by it. One of my greatest influences, and I know one of your greatest influences too, is Professor Martin Carver, who has done so much great work at Sutton Hoo. And he was there, and I've always been rather nervous about exposing academics to my book, because I've always feared they would go, oh, that's rubbish, oh, what an imposter. But in fact, Martin stood up during the Q&A and entirely unprompted gave a most heartwarming, passionate endorsement of the book and the pleasure that he took from it, which that was like all my Christmases Aww. And birthdays wrapped into one. I went home singing after that.
Oh, that's really lovely. And you know, I did want to ask you if, well, I've spotted quite a lot of little Easter eggs that I suspect were wrapped up specifically for me to find. But I've also, on a rereading, I have been noticing other things as well that are clearly jokes for people who get the joke. But if you don't get the joke, then it's fine. And it wasn't until I was reading the phrase the Norland mercenaries, and I thought, well, that sounds a bit familiar. Oh, now the Norland thing that you normally think of is the Norland nanny. Was that always put in right from the start as a very slow burn joke?
Yes, I think so. I think that one was more a joke to myself. I think I just enjoyed constructing that phrase. But I know the one that you, I think you were the first person to notice that one of my original Viking band was called Martin Hennig, and he ends up being killed when he accidentally takes a hallucinogen while trying to murder the Anglo-Saxons. Martin Hennig, as we both know, is the gentlest soul, a really senior academic in the archaeological world, isn't he?
But
his name, I think, is great for a Viking.
But he's the least bloodthirsty, the least Viking-y kind of man you could ever hope to meet. So, yes, I know. I think everybody's just been in hysterics at that bit, going, how can this man be called Martin Hennig? It's just great. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Tony. It's been so lovely chatting to you, so lovely to see you and catch up. And don't forget, everyone, The House of Wolf is available now in the Time Team shop. You just go to timeteamdigital.com. The podcast returns next week, where I'll be answering some of the archaeology and Time Team questions sent in by Time Team members. So don't forget to hit follow however you listen to your podcasts to never miss an episode. Speaking of Time Team members, if you'd like to support the work we do here at Time Team, then why not consider becoming a Time Team member? Your money funds the excavations and the programmes about them, but you'll also get all sorts of benefits, such as behind-the-scenes videos and masterclasses and the chance to join us on future projects. So head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial now for a free 7-day trial. But until next time, thank you so much for listening, and I'll speak to you again soon on the next Time Team podcast.
Hi there, it's me, Tony Robinson. I'm back with a brand new series of Cunning Cast, my cunningly curated podcast where I dig into the histories of the stuff which fascinates me most. In Cunning Cast Series 3, I'm exploring fascinating new topics, including uncovering the mysteries of Sutton Hoo, in search of shipwrecks and sunken cities, new discoveries at Stonehenge.
There's this basic drive to build something that incorporates very different parts of Britain into a single monument.
Who is Vladimir Putin and what makes him tick?
There are some people who are genuine Putin friends. These aren't government officials. After all, what's the point? If you are close to the boss, why not just become obscenely rich?
Who wrote the Bible?
It's basically really taking the pit out of the Roman Empire. It can't do it explicitly, but it's really saying these Romans are a nasty piece of work.
Why were the Beatles such great songwriters?
He's got this intuitive genius, and very little of it is kind of like consciously articulated or explainable even to himself.
No subject is off limits because everything has a history. So join me, Tony Robinson, for the return of my podcast, Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast. Now available wherever you get your podcasts. Go on, give it a try. You might like it.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.